Hello and welcome to the Crisis Point Podcast. I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before we get into today's podcast, I just want to remind people to like and subscribe. Subscribe to the channel wherever you listen to or watch it. And also make sure you like this video. That helps other people find out about it. You know, I hate saying that every time, but I feel like I have to because that's what everybody else does. And it does really help. It's not just something we just say. Podcast hosts just say it really does help branch out and let other people find out about the podcast. So make sure you hit that subscribe button, hit the like button. I'd really appreciate it. Thanks. Okay, so today it's going to be a little bit different in that I just kind of wanted to discuss with everybody a topic that's been on my mind recently, particularly because of what's been happening lately in the church. In the world around us. And it's something, though, that's not new to us. Crisis Magazine was founded in 1982. So that's almost 40 years ago. I guess we'll have to do something for a 40th anniversary next year. That's almost 40 years ago Crisis Magazine has been around. And the title, the name of Crisis Magazine tells you what it's about. It's about the crisis in the church and in the culture. In fact, the original name of it was Catholicism in Crisis, but then branch out a little bit more into just the crisis in the world as well as the church. So obviously in the early 1980s, some people thought that there was a crisis that needed to be addressed. And it's still true today. I actually would love it if Crisis Magazine outlived its usefulness in the sense that there was no crisis anymore that we had to deal with, and we could just disband, go home, and raise good Catholic families and be left alone doing that. But obviously, we're nowhere near that. In fact, I would argue that there is I would argue that today is probably the lowest point of the church and also in the world, at least in America, since that was written, since Crisis Magazine was founded in 1982. It's hard to see. I mean, I've lived through over 20 some years of it as a Catholic, and I'm older than, I was born before 1982, so I've lived through all of it in a way. And I would say today is a low point, really. And I just want to give four examples from the past just couple months of the crisis we're facing right now. The first, the recent stories about Monsignor Burrell, who was a general secretary of the USCCB and the Pillar Catholic news agency, they found that he was engaged in some very inappropriate behavior, using Grindr to hook up with other men and things. I don't even want to get into more details, but doing these terrible things. But he was the highest ranking non-bishop church official in America. And he was engaged in this terrible activity. And as we know, this is just one example of corruption in the clergy. Uncle Ted McCarrick was finally charged with criminal offenses recently, which is great. It's about time he was, but you know, that's an ongoing saga right there. And so we have that's the first thing recently, corruption in the hierarchy, in the bishops with the priests. We have this deep corruption. And it's not just that we have corruption, because we've always had corruption in the church. I mean, let's be honest here. Original sin impacts us all. We've always had corruption. What's amazing, though, is how even after what happened in 2002 with the great exposure of all the predator priests that there were and the bishops doing nothing, all the talk about we have to do something about this, we still aren't really any further advanced than we were back in 2002. In fact, I would say maybe we're worse. I mean, you saw from the Monsignor Burrell response, more people were worried about the Pillar exposing what he had done than the fact that he actually had done these things. And so the corruption in the clergy is definitely a big case of example of the crisis in the church today. The second thing I would say that we're facing right now is what I call the COVID regime. And this is basically people both outside and inside the church working to restrict our freedoms in the name of stopping the spread or whatever the phrase they're using these days. And the COVID regime, now, okay, just before I continue, I'm not denying COVID. I'm not denying it's a virus. I'm not denying people have died from it. I'm not denying it can be very serious for some people, particularly those over the age of 70 or who have pre-existing conditions that make them susceptible to COVID, to some bad results of having COVID. That being said, the reaction, this has basically been an opportunity for our elites to control us. They're using COVID to control us. And we see this particularly in the political elites. But what we're seeing in the church is completely laying down and allowing the elites to control us, saying, oh, yeah, mass is non-essential. I predicted today on Twitter that by the end of the year, some Catholic parish is going to require the COVID vaccination in order to receive communion. I just think it's obviously, it's inevitable it's going to happen. So there's another example of the crisis in the church is this COVID and in the world, this COVID regime that is very quickly overtaking us and taking away our freedoms, and in the church taking away our freedom to worship, our freedom to receive communion as we want to, like, for example, on the tongue and even to attend mass. The third example is what I would of the crisis today is what I would call faux Catholicism. And I'm talking about people like Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, Father James Martin, people who are outwardly claim to be Catholic, outwardly claim to even speak for the church in the case of like someone like Father Martin, but they don't really live a Catholic faith. They don't really preach a Catholic faith. In fact, they preach a counter gospel, a gospel of the devil, to be quite blunt. I mean, obviously Father Martin does this, but Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi and others, this faux Catholicism that just infects us. And again, here's a case where we see the hierarchy doing nothing about it. It's simply, they'll dither along about, we'll have documents, whether or not Biden should receive communion, things like that. Another pro-abortion Catholics, but ultimately they're doing nothing. And so faux Catholicism has become the dominant force in the Catholic Church today. There's our third crisis. The fourth crisis is very recent, and it's what's happened with Pope Francis trying to suppress the traditional Latin Mass. I've already talked about that in a previous podcast, and we've gone over that at Crisis Magazine, of course, and so you can look at those articles. But clearly this is a case of the Pope, the highest authority in the church, is trying to suppress the Mass of the ages, the Mass that has fostered devotion and piety in saints throughout the centuries and is an established and known way to bring people closer to Christ and to worship God in a holy way. And he's trying to suppress it. And so that's obviously another one. And so those are just four examples, the corruption in the hierarchy, the COVID regime, faux Catholicism, and the suppression of the traditional Latin Mass. Those are just four recent examples. I'm only talking about the last couple months, things in the news of the crisis in the church and in the world. Now, okay, I want to address the thing that I hear probably more often, the most common criticism of what we do at Crisis Magazine. And that is, why do you talk about the crisis so much? Why are you all focused on bad news? How does that help bring people closer to God? Well, I would argue very strongly that burying your head in the sand does not bring anybody closer to God. What we see are millions and millions of souls being led away from Jesus Christ, being led away from his Catholic Church. And they're led away because of things like these crises that I've mentioned already. They're led away by corrupt clergy. They're led away by the church saying that basically Mass is non-essential. They're led away by faux Catholicism, probably more than any of these things. Probably faux Catholicism is the thing that leads them away the most. They're led away by the suppression of traditional ways of worship and of prayer and piety and spirituality. All these things are leading people away from Jesus Christ. And so, yeah, we can hunker down and we can just say, okay, I'm going to go la, 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 la. I'm not going to listen. I'm not going to care about what's going on around me. I'm going to ignore it all and just hunker down. But if we do that, those souls will continue to be lost. And we do have some responsibility for that. We live in this age. And so we have a responsibility to evangelize the world, to tell others about Christ. But that means we have to address what's going on in the church. So for those who think that we should just bury our heads in the sand, I just think we can't do that. Now, that doesn't mean that's all we think about and all we talk about and all we do is the crisis in the church. I mean, in my own life, for example, I run Crisis Magazine. So obviously a lot of our articles that we publish, that I approve, that I edit, and that I put on the website are addressing negative things in the church. Now, hopefully we give ways to overcome them, but that doesn't mean I spend my entire day, every day, just thinking about the idea of, just thinking about what's negative in the church. No, I do not spend my whole day every day thinking about that. I think about the good things much more than I do about the bad things, but I do think it's important to address these issues, always with how we bring up, how we advance and advance the gospel and help reform the church. Okay, so what do we do then? What is our response? I would say our response is resistance. It's resistance. There needs to be a Catholic resistance movement. I think Catholics should be preparing themselves to resist what's going on in the church and in the world. And this is something Catholics have always done in the past. For example, when England was overtaken by Henry VIII and Anglicanism, when the Anglican Church was formed and they tried to push out Catholicism, there were the recusants in England at the time that resisted, and they resisted and they continued to live the Catholic faith. And we have saints and martyrs from that time that give us an example of the ways we resist. Another resistance movement would have been during the third century when the Arian crisis hit, when people were, when bishops left and right were embracing heresy, the Arian heresy. The lay people, they resisted. They refused to follow those bishops that were trying to lead them into heresy. And so we have a history of Catholics resisting both things that happen outside the church and inside the church as well. This is not something new to our time. Now, certain aspects of it are new to our time potentially, but overall, the idea of resistance is not new. And so we really do need to form a resistance movement so that we can overcome these crises in the church and really bring the church back to her former glory, but not even necessarily her former glory, but just the glory that she's always been called to. And so one thing we have to do in this resistance, we have to stop thinking our leaders are going to save us. We have to stop thinking that, oh, if we just get the right pope or we just get the right bishops, that all of a sudden everything will be fine. If we just get the right president or the right speaker of the house, whatever, things will be better. That's not how it's going to work, in my opinion. I think it's going to be the lay people, the common people, who are basically going to be the forerunners of the resistance and are going to be the ones that eventually overcome the evil of our time. It's not going to be some bishop who's going to save us. I mean, we've already seen that bishops in particular have a knack for disappointing us. I mean, even the good ones, put that in quotes, the good ones, they often disappoint us. And while I think we should pray for them, we should encourage them when they do good things, and we should challenge them when they don't, we can't count on them to be the leaders of the resistance. I think that's going to have to be the lay people and just regular priests who are going to be leading the resistance movement. And so what do I mean by a Catholic resistance movement? Well, I think it's two different things. I think it's twofold. It is both because we have both a political crisis and an ecclesial or religious crisis. And I think how we respond to these two different crises, how we resist them, is different. I don't think we have the same methodology for each because of the fact that they are different in how they are formed, how they exist. On the political side, we have political systems that are 100% human oriented. They're 100% of human origin. Democracy, while it might be the greatest form of government, a democratic republic we have, of course, in America, might be one of the greatest forms of government ever created. It's not a divine method of government. Our political system here in America is not divinely instituted. And so therefore anything is up for grabs. We can do anything we need to in order to resist our political leaders, resist our political movement. Our political parties, frankly, will not save us. I'm sorry, but for those, I know most listeners of the Crisis Point podcast are probably Republicans, but the Republican Party will not save you. We all know the Democrat Party is lost. It's demonic. It's evil. It you know, no Catholic should be a member of the Democratic Party, frankly. But that being said, the Republican Party is, over the past, let's say, 30 years, is a history of failure, a history of just basically saying one thing and then refusing to actually back it up with action. It's full of words. And we see this time and time again. And so if we think that we're going to be safe if we just get the next Republican president or something like that, we're kidding ourselves. I mean, you know, there's a few Republicans that I can stand. I won't say like Rand Paul, somebody like that, but they're not going to save us. And so thinking that a political party will save us, I think, is not the answer. I think we need a more fundamental shift. And this is something I wrote in an article for Crisis back in December before I was even editor of the magazine. I think the S word should be used when we're talking about politics. What's the S word? Secession. I think secession should be a viable option. It shouldn't be a dirty word in American politics anymore. Yes, I know the second an American says the word secession, they're called a racist. Whatever. We can't do anything about that. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at the history of the world, secession is not tied to racism in any way. It's not tied to slavery, and it's not even necessarily tied to violence. That's what I think is one thing that we should be seriously looking at, is a nonviolent secession. Look at how the Soviet Union broke up. There was secession on a large scale, and nary a shot was fired. And so when I say I'm calling for secession, I'm not calling for reinstitution of the Confederate States. I'm not calling for anything violent either. I do think, though, that we need to really embrace this Catholic subsidiarity. We need to really embrace that, this idea that we need to be governed locally. We see that with the COVID regime in particular, that we see that all these governors, they feel like they have to do what the other governors are doing because of this federal system we have. But really, what we should be doing is simply governing ourselves locally and doing what we think is right. I know the county next to mine where I live, I remember when they had the mask mandate, the county sheriff said, "Nope, I'm not going to enforce it." And I was like, "That's great. That's exactly what he should do." His people didn't want it. And that's what, that's really what we should be doing, is just simply refusing these orders from the federal government, refusing to comply with them. This is particularly true with COVID and everything involved with that. We just simply should no longer abide by these federal laws as much as we can. And we should really promote states' rights, but also even more locally than that, your county, your township, your city, doing things at a more local level. So I'd say one way that Catholics can resist is through promoting a more localized governing system than we have today. Do not expect any government leader, any politician in Washington to save you, or even in your state capital, frankly. That's a way that we can resist. Now, so we're talking about resisting politically. Everything is on the table, because we can just completely overturn our current form of government and create a new one. Because like I said, they're all of human origin. That's not the case, however, when we're talking about church reform, resistance to our ecclesial authorities. Because the fact of the matter is our system of government, of hierarchy in the Catholic Church, is divinely instituted. The Pope and the bishops and the priests, the hierarchy, all that, and even deacons, that is divinely instituted by our Lord. We cannot overcome that. There is no such thing as secession from the Catholic Church. That's called schism. That's called leaving the Catholic Church. That's called putting your soul, eternal soul, in jeopardy. There is no secession from the Catholic Church. There's no secession from the Pope either. We have to be in union with him. And so what do I mean when I say we have to have a resistance even to ecclesial authorities? Now, one of a common thing that came up this few years ago, this recognize and resist became like a movement. And I think it was first associated with Taylor Marshall. I'm not 100% sure about that. This idea that you recognize Pope Francis as the legitimate Pope, but you resist him when he works against Catholic tradition. And I first found out about it because excuse me, people started saying that about me, that I was part of Recognize and Resist, R&R, and I didn't even know what it meant. And honestly, I wasn't really taken by the phrase, but it's not inaccurate either. That's exactly what we're about here at Crisis, is that we recognize that Pope Francis is the Pope, that he is a legitimate successor of St. Peter, and that we have no authority to say he isn't, no matter what. And so, but however, we do resist when the Pope or any other ecclesial authority does something against the Catholic faith. No matter what, we resist it. So if even the Pope says that the death penalty is no longer acceptable, that it goes against the dignity of human life, we resist that. And we say, no, that's not true. When even the Pope says that divorced and remarried people who have not gotten annulment, they can receive, and they're still living in the state of sin, that they can receive communion, we resist that. We do resist that. So we do recognize that Francis is the Pope, but we do resist it. Now, I do want to say that this idea of Catholics resisting their ecclesial authorities is not normal. That's not the way it should be in the Catholic Church. We shouldn't have to resist our church authorities, our bishops, or even the Pope or anybody like that. That's not normal. But it's also not unprecedented. Again, look at the Arian crisis. What happened in the 4th century? I think I said 3rd century earlier, but it's the 4th century is when the Arian crisis happened, of course. You had the vast majority of bishops embracing an explicit heresy and promoting it. What were you supposed to do as a Catholic, as a Catholic layperson? Even the Pope at that time wasn't that great on this issue. He even excommunicated St. Athanasius, who was the only bishop who was truly great on this issue. So what was a lay Catholic supposed to do? Was he supposed to just go along because, hey, his bishop said that Arianism is the way to go, that there once was a time that he was not, speaking of Jesus Christ? Are you just supposed to go along with that? No, you resist that. Why do you resist that? Because you know it's contrary to the Catholic faith as it has been handed on to you. And so we do have a resistance. But we don't, well, basically, I think what Recognize and Resist does, it goes against the two extremes. On the one extreme is a complete cult-like acceptance of what's going on in the churches. Everything is awesome. We basically sing the Lego theme song of everything is awesome, and we act like, you know, we're living part of the dream. No, that's one extreme we cannot go down, because we're not cult members, and you can't say 2 + 2 = 5, no matter how much a Catholic authority tells you you can. On the other extreme, though, we don't leave the church, and we don't go the route of the Sedi Vacantinus. We don't go the route of saying that Francis isn't really the Pope. We have no reason to believe that Francis is not the Pope. We have no reason to reject his papacy. And we have no authority, even if we had a reason, if we suspected that he wasn't the Pope, we have no authority to reject that he's the legitimate Pope. So those are two extremes where we resist those two extremes, and we try to go down what I call the Catholic middle, that we continue to embrace tradition, we continue to embrace what the Catholic Church has always taught, and when our church leaders go against that, we simply will resist that. And how do we resist that, though? How do we prepare ourselves as Catholics to resist that in the church? The first thing is, we know our faith. We know what the faith teaches us. And how do we know that? We read the catechism. Particularly, I would recommend the Baltimore Catechism. I know it's old. I know it's simple. I know it's made for kids. But honestly, I think that's the best way to learn the faith. In my own parish, our adult conversion class, we're using the Baltimore Catechism number 3 because it's just a great way to know the faith. And so we know the faith. And we understand it, so that when something happens, like where all of a sudden the Pope says the death penalty is against the dignity of human life, we know that's not true because we know our faith. We know our faith about divorce and remarried, not being able to receive communion. We know why that's true. So we learn our faith. That's the first thing we do to resist. We have to know the faith, because that keeps us off those extremes. It keeps us down the straight and narrow of Catholicism. Also, we do practical things like in how we live our Catholic faith. We pray the rosary every day. We go to Mass, obviously, every Sunday. We go to a reverent Mass, preferably the traditional Latin Mass. But we go to a Mass where Catholicism is preached and practiced. We go to a parish like that, even if it means a major hardship for you, even if it means you're driving over an hour. I know people who drive literally 2 or 3 hours one way to attend a mass that they know is faithful to Catholicism. And so we live the faith out. So we know the faith, we live the faith out. We also refuse to support corrupt bishops, corrupt priests, corrupt hierarchy that isn't promoting the Catholic faith. You don't give money to the USCCB. Absolutely not. You don't give money to Peter's Pence because we know what they've done with that. They used that to fund Elton John's gay movie and other such things. We don't give money to those things. Now, there's always the problem of if you're in a good parish, what do you do? Because if you give money to your parish, they have to give money to the diocese. I don't have a great answer for you, to be honest. I give money to my parish because my parish is awesome. I know part of that goes to the diocese, and I can't do much about that. excuse me. Sorry about that. But we do everything we can to give money to faithful Catholic traditional orders, to local groups that help the poor, local pro-life groups. We do everything we can to get to funnel our resources to them. And you should be giving money to somebody, by the way. I don't care what situation you're in, you have a little extra money you can give away. And I guarantee if you give away, the more you give away, the more God will bless your activities. And I'm not, this is like an anti-prosperity gospel in the sense of the more we give, the more that we do receive. But you have to give with good stewardship, only to those places and those organizations that are really promoting the faith, really practicing the faith and giving to the poor and pro-life groups, things like that. And so also we need to form communities. Okay, now I know I'm going to immediately hear people saying, oh, you're talking about the Benedict option. Roger's Benedict option. Isn't Roger, didn't he leave the church and things like that? And yes, I am in a way talking about the Benedict option. And the Benedict option to me, the way I've always interpreted it is that you build a community such that it can adapt and it's anti-fragile. What I mean by that is it can adapt to the surrounding situation that you're facing in the world. So if things are getting bad, you have a community to depend on, a parish that will remain faithful, for example, an area where you live where things won't get crazy. You're not living in New York City, for example, or Los Angeles, somewhere like that, where frankly, you just are asking for it. You're asking for it that things are going to get terrible for you. So you live in a community like that, but you also, you can adapt to that, but it's also anti-fragile, meaning that when things get bad, you have ways that you can survive that you're already resisting. So you do things like you homeschool. I mean, that's one of the best ways to do it is you homeschool. I know there are some decent Catholic schools out there, and obviously those decent Catholic schools you should support, but I think they're few and far between. And so you should, homeschooling is a definite option, and you form community with other homeschoolers. So no matter what critical race or other crap they're throwing in the local schools, you're resisting it by not engaging in it. You do things like you form support networks so that, for example, when somebody loses a job in your community, you know about it, you can help them. You can help bring them meals. You can help maybe help them find another job. You can maybe financially support them, whatever the case may be. Maybe you have an old car that you don't need anymore. You can give to them or sell to them very cheap. These are ways of resistance because what they do is they help you withstand when things get worse in the future. And that's something that I don't think we're yet at the point of for example, 16th century England or early 20th century Russia or Nazi Germany, anything like that. We're not at that level. But I think anybody who's paying attention should know that's the direction we're going, that we're going in the direction of things getting worse and worse, both in the church and in the world. And so we can resist that. And we do that, we can resist that in a joyful fashion. This isn't us just saying, oh, woe is me, things are so terrible. This is us saying we can follow the Lord in any situation, and he's given us the gift of reason to prepare for those bad times. And that's what we should be doing now. And so what we do is we form a resistance unit. We form a resistance unit in our communities, in our parishes, where we are involved in both active and passive resistance. Active resistance meaning trying to do things in our community, our local governments, wherever the case may be, to overturn the COVID regime, to work with our diocese to try to get it to encourage traditional Latin masses and to discourage heresy and things like that. But also passive resistance in the sense that we're living our Catholic faith fully and without compromise. We're not trying to fit in with the faux Catholicism around us. We're not trying to just go along with what our church leaders say, even when we know it goes against Catholic tradition. We do all these things because we want souls to be gained for heaven. By doing this, what we're doing is we're setting up a way that souls will not be lost. That's the whole reason for this. We're trying to protect souls. And by creating these communities, these ways of resistance, what we're doing is we're giving a light, so to speak, on the hill, shining so that those who want to come out of the darkness of this world, out of the darkness of corruption in the clergy, whatever, they see the way we're living. They're saying, I want to embrace that. I want to live this Catholic faith like they're living it. And so that's why we're doing this. We're not doing this because we're like Eeyores that are just, woe is me. We're doing this because we want to be examples for others. We want to be, to evangelize our neighbors, evangelize those around us for the Catholic faith. So are Catholics today prepared to resist? Sadly, I think most are not, frankly. I don't think most Catholics are prepared to resist. We saw this with what happened in 2020, that most Catholics just went along with all the different restrictions. They went along and just said, okay, whatever our government leaders say, we're just going to go along with it. They have not really resisted our ecclesial leaders when they've shown corruption. They've done very little about that. But I would encourage everybody to really find ways to resist, both in your own family, in your community, in the church, in your political world, whatever the case may be, find ways to resist so that we can stand up to these crises that are happening in the church today. Okay, I think I'm going to cut it there. We're about half hour. That's usually about how long I like to do it for. I really want to just encourage everybody to continue to live the Catholic faith, know the Catholic faith, pray the Catholic faith, everything that it means to be Catholic. That's our number one way to resist. And so I really encourage everybody to do that. Okay, well, until next time, God love you.